You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There were many scientific advances in the 20th century that seem, in retrospect, astonishing. One can only wonder at what science will bring in the next 100 years. Michio Kaku, a theoretical physicist and one of the founders of string field theory, set out to discover what's percolating in the labs of more than 300 of the world's leading scientists. In his latest book, Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100, Mr. Kaku explains what the likely scientific achievements will be in the next 30, 70, and 100 years. It's published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased that it brings Michio Kaku back to our show today. Welcome.
Glad to be on.
How different are the things you discuss in this book from the ones in your previous book, The Physics of the Impossible?
Well, you know, as a kid, I've always been interested in the future. But in books like Visions, I went 20 years into the future, and all the predictions I laid out were right on schedule. And then Physics of the Impossible, I even talked about inventions that go thousands of years into the future, like warp drive and time machines. However, this book here is about the year 2100. It's a big leap, but as you mentioned, I've interviewed 300 of the world's top scientists for BBC television, Discovery Channel, Science Channel, and radio, and I put all their thoughts in one book.
But how much can we actually predict about the future? Aren't most of the things that happen surprises? I always think of the film 2001, HAL was a huge computer. By 2001, everything had been miniaturized. We could not have predicted Facebook 20 years ago or so many of the things that just seem to fall into our laps and then take over.
It's difficult, but in 1863, Jules Verne, at the time of the American Civil War, writes a book called Paris in the 20th Century, and he predicts what Paris is going to be look like in 1960. He predicted in the time of Abraham Lincoln that we would have glass skyscrapers, we would have gasoline-fired cars, we would have fax machines, and something resembling the internet. Well, if Jules Verne could do it, I said to myself, well, I can try too.
Well, it seems that people in Japan couldn't predict some pretty basic things, despite the fact that they built these power plants, these nuclear power plants, close to three fault lines. Is that the problem, or is a problem with nuclear power? Since the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, you've been monitoring the dangers to the plants, and you've appeared on CNN as an expert and also been blogging about them.
Well, you have to realize that once-in-a-century events are extremely hard to predict, and this was the fifth largest earthquake ever recorded since 1900, but they do take place on a scale of 100 years. And unfortunately, engineers sometimes say, not in my lifetime, not in the lifetime of my children. But what about in the lifetime of our grandkids? Do we have once-in-a-century earthquakes like that? For example, they had walls to protect them against tsunamis at Fukushima, but the walls were about 15 feet tall. The tidal wave that hit was 25 feet tall and therefore flooded all the emergency systems and caused the accident.
Yeah, well, they had some pretty sophisticated stuff there. The Chileans had been able to withstand a pretty terrible earthquake and tsunami. What's the difference there?
Well, the difference is that Japan has made the Faustian bargain with nuclear energy, concentrating an enormous number right next to the ocean because it has no domestic oil, coal, or hydro resources of its own. And Faust was the mythical figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power. That's the Faustian bargain. And unfortunately, Japan lost on this one. Huge chunks of northern Japan will probably be sealed off for a generation. It may take years, maybe a decade, to clean up this mess at Fukushima.
Well, we have our own closest nuclear facility at Indian Point near two fault lines. Can't we build them in safer places? But then I think about Three Mile Island, and that wasn't near a fault line, was it?
Yeah, the problem is
Chernobyl wasn't near a fault line.
Yeah, the problem is Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant lies next to the Ramapo Fault, which is active. It has had smaller earthquakes in the past. But the United States government did a study called Crack 2 back in the 1980s, where they tried to estimate what would happen if Indian Point went up in smoke and other reactors. And the results were quite astonishing. In 1980 dollars, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars in property damage. done by a study done by Sandia Laboratories, a division that contracts with the United States government. So we've known for quite a while that what is called a Class 9 nuclear accident could literally cripple the economy of the United States. But we, too, in some sense, have made this Faustian bargain. It's not going to happen in our lifetime.
So where do you think we'll be getting our energy in the next century?
Well, in the book, Physics of the Future, I try to go 10, 50, 100 years into the future. Right now, fossil fuels costs are rising, even though they're erratic, while solar, hydrogen, renewable technologies are falling. And in about 10 years, the two curves will cross. And at that point, it becomes economical to, for example, make the Sahara Desert a gigantic solar plant. And even beyond that, fusion becomes an option in maybe 20 to 30 years. The French and the European Union and the U.S. have backed the ITER fusion reactor in southern France. And something that was once considered fantastic, it may actually become commercial within 20 years.
Isn't part of the problem we have been unable to develop really efficient batteries?
Yeah. 100 years ago, Thomas Edison and Henry Ford were friends and had a bet. What would power the automobiles of the future? Edison bet on batteries. Ford bet on gasoline. Ford won. Because pound for pound, gasoline has more energy stored in it than a car battery. Because gasoline is concentrated sunlight since the time of the dinosaurs. And it's still extremely hard to beat gasoline.
But we have to get rid of it. First of all, it's not renewable. We have to get rid of our dependency on it. So you're saying it's going to just wind up being, we'll develop better batteries and an awful lot of windmills and solar panels wherever possible?
It's going to be a mix. For the next 10 years, we're going to have a mix with no white knight in sight. However, in 10 years' time, with the falling of solar, hydrogen, and renewable technology, it's going to be competitive. But we'll still have a mix of energy into the future until we go to fusion, and then seawater will be the power source.
And so that's what you're predicting, fusion?
By mid-century, we should go fusion. And this means that the greenhouse effect will be dangerous only for the next few decades. We could really mess up the planet in the next few decades, but after that, we'll enter the solar fusion era, in which case glasses of water will energize whole cities.
Well, you said we can only mess up the planet for a few decades, but there's still a lot of resistance to even thinking that there is such a thing as a greenhouse effect. And we have people in Congress who are saying this is the greatest hoax of the century.
Well, nobody disagrees that the Earth is heating up. That's a matter of fact. We simply look it up. Last year went down as the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science, tied with 2003. So the Earth is heating up. The question is, what's driving it? And that's where we can get into some disagreement, whether it's human or whether it's a natural cycle. But everyone agrees that the Earth is heating up.
My guest is Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, one of the founders of string field theory and best-selling author of several science books. His latest is called Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives in the Year 2100. Published by Doubleday. You said that if the Japanese prime minister asked you what to do about the current situation, you would recommend the Chernobyl option. What's that?
Well, right now it's a race against time. The situation at Fukushima is stable. They're running power lines. But if the power lines don't work, the pumps don't work, they may have to evacuate. It's too dangerous there. And if they evacuate, we're going to be in free fall. That a meltdown will be a certainty. Three meltdowns will be a certainty. And then I advocate the Chernobyl option, that is calling out the Japanese Air Force, the same way that Gorbachev called out the Red Air Force to sandbag and bury the Chernobyl reactor in a tomb of concrete, sand, and boric acid. It's the last final option. You know, we've thrown everything at that reactor except the kitchen sink. Now is the time to think about the kitchen sink.
Well, there was resistance to throwing anything at it because TEPCO didn't want to lose the reactors and actually wound up being penny wise, pound foolish. Is that a problem when you're messing with something like this? That I mean, they did not expect – they weren't thinking about the spent fuel rods, which have been the major problem here.
Yeah, according to the New York Times, at every single step of the way, TEPCO, the utility, tried to stonewall recommendations of the government, which saw a much wider accident because they didn't want to lose their investment of billions of dollars. You realize there are six units, six nuclear power plants at one site. And they didn't want to lose their investment, so it just kept getting worse and worse. That's why I advocate that we let the Japanese Air Force take over.
Now, a lot of people in Japan are blaming the government. Should they?
Well, I think the government has also been slow, and the credibility of the utility and the government is in a meltdown right now. People are evacuating on their own, far beyond the 12-mile limit that was recommended by the government. The United States has recommended a 50-mile radius. So people are evacuating on their own. They're voting with their feet. They don't believe the government.
And now radiation has turned up in food. What are they going to be doing in the near future? Is it going to be like Chernobyl where nobody can eat anything for centuries?
It could be worse than Chernobyl because we have three partial meltdowns plus one open spent fuel pond that contains more radiation than the reactors themselves. Already, tap water in Tokyo is beginning to register tiny amounts of radiation. Milk and canola, spinach, already have registered large quantities of radiation. In fact, beyond legal limits. By law, they have to impound some of the milk and spinach being found 20 to 60 miles from the reactor.
Every image I've gotten on the news has people wearing face masks, which seems to me to be useless. They are also, there's no iodine salt available in Japan. Now, are these folk remedies?
Potassium iodide is sometimes called the doomsday pill because it floods the thyroid gland with ordinary iodine, preventing iodine-131 from getting in. So that is like a Band-Aid, but also in the nuclear waste, you'll find cesium, strontium. Strontium concentrates in the bone marrow, and cesium will concentrate everywhere, including the muscle. So iodide pills is nothing but a Band-Aid.
Let's talk about some of the other things that you discuss in this book. Remarkable improvements in medicine, you say, that are not all that far off. By 2030, you say, the work of a Stanford engineer, Stephen R. Quake, is about to revolutionize gene sequencing. Now, Quake is an unfortunate name these days, but what's he doing?
Yeah, we're talking about personal genomics. That is, on your credit card in the future, you may have all your entire gene sequences, which will be the basis for medicine to find out what kinds of diseases you'll have in the future. And in fact, even your toilet will begin to do some of your gene sequences by analyzing proteins emitted from cancer colonies 10 years before a tumor forms. And so your smart toilet could actually make the word tumor become extinct, vanish from the English language because of DNA technology.
Who would have access to that information? Isn't there a privacy concern there?
Well, people will have to, of course, willingly buy smart toilets and smart mirrors that'll analyze their proteins for cancer. But remember that Aretha Franklin suffers from pancreatic cancer. Patrick Swayze of Dirty Dancing fame died of pancreatic cancer. And in the future, pancreatic cancer may be a thing of the past because we'll pick up proteins from 100 cancer cells 10 years before it kills you. Compliments of your toilet, your bathroom mirror, and this is coming very fast.
Even if the cancer is detected, you're right that a new organ will simply be grown using cells from your body?
That's right.
This is not stem cell.
Not even with stem cells. Already, we can grow from your own cells. We can grow bone, skin, cartilage, nose, ears, blood vessels, heart valves. The first bladder was grown 4 years ago. The first windpipe last year from your own cells.
So we're just, you say, 20 years from that.
And 5 years, we'll grow the first liver. So think of all the alcoholics out there who will love that fact. Mickey Mantle died of liver failure, for example.
Yeah, but we were promised at least a decade ago that stem cell research would cure an awful lot of things by now. And
yeah,
it hasn't happened.
Right. The therapies that I mentioned are not using stem cells at all. This is already in the laboratories. They use ordinary cells and hit them with growth factors, and they grow in a sponge. Stem cell technology is more sophisticated. We'll be able to grow anything with stem cells, but it's still in its infancy.
We'll take a little break. We'll come back with more. My guest is Michio Kaku. He is a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, co-founder of the string field theory and author of a number of best-selling books. The book we're discussing is Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. It is published by Doubleday. Stay with us. We're back with Michio Kaku, who we've been talking about his books and his teaching, but he also has a Science Channel TV show, Sci-Fi Science, The Physics of the Impossible, and also hosts two radio shows, Explorations and Science Fantastic. His latest book is Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Let's spend just a few more moments on stem cells and move on. Why has it been so difficult to come up with real theories? Is it because when you start cells growing, you can't necessarily control them? Could stem cells not only cure things but also give us cancer?
Well, in principle, stem cells are the mother of all cells. That is, one stem cell can, in principle, create brain cells, heart cells, any cell of the body, because all the genes are encoded within the stem cells. But once the stem cells becomes an adult stem cell, it's already differentiated. It's already chosen to become a heart cell. So to change it back, you have to wrench. You have to wrench quite a few of its genes so that it becomes young again and then becomes a brain cell, for example. So the technology is there. We know we can do it. In animals, we've had enormous strides. But in humans, it will take time.
Well, there was it was set back to some degree by the Bush administration's policies, but have things improved a lot since the Obama administration took over?
Well, it was in the courts then. Obama opened up the floodgates so that federal funding can go into the research. Then a judge held it up, and it goes back and forth, back and forth. And meanwhile, we have a brain drain. Some of our best brains are going to Asia and Europe because there are no such constraints overseas, which I think is sad. So the human body shop, where you can simply order a part as they wear out, it's coming. But as far as stem cells are concerned, it's going to take a little bit of time.
You also write about the revolutionary promise of gene therapy by mid-century, around 2030 to 2070. What's that?
Gene therapy is the ability to fix broken genes. Many diseases like cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs, sickle cell anemia, which afflicts many Americans, are due to breaks or mutations in one gene. And in fact, P53, which is involved in 50% of all common cancers, is one of the targets of gene therapy, so that we might be able to fix P53 and in some sense cure cancer.
On the other hand, you also talk about designer children, where parents will be able to design their own children. This is the downside of this sort of thing?
Well, yes and no. Some people may want this technology. We already have smart mice.
Sounds like Brave New World to me.
Well, remember that in Brave New World, it was an elite that undemocratically chose certain people to become mentally retarded and certain people to become alphas or leaders of society. I think in a democratic society, people will choose for themselves how far we want to go to redesign ourselves. Now, remember, at the present time, it's still very primitive. No one is talking about being able to create Homo Superior or Superman or anything like that. However, right now, gene therapy is focused on curing diseases which involved a single mutation. But remember that in mice, we already have bred a group of smart mice that can navigate mazes much faster than an ordinary mouse, and also the mighty mouse, who's muscle-bound. And we have a human counterpart for both genes, and muscle builders have expressed enormous interest in the mighty mouse gene.
Because they wouldn't have to use steroids.
That's right. It's very difficult to detect. In fact, the Olympics have set up a committee. Some of my friends are on that committee to precisely look at whether or not we can detect athletes that have the mighty mouse gene.
Now, would there be any bad side effects to this sort of thing? Because there sure are to steroids.
Well, the smart mouse gene does have some side effects. These mice can navigate much faster. They have much better memory than ordinary mice. But some of them tend to be timid because they remember too much. That's the theory. The theory is that if you're too smart, you remember all your failures as well as successes. Sometimes you have to forget your failures. Sometimes you do have to become a little dumber in order to leap ahead.
In the nanotechnology section, you quote Nobel laureate Richard Smalley as saying, that eventually the goal is not just to make computers the size of dust particles. The idea would be to make simple computers the size of bacteria. Then you could get something as powerful as what's now on your desktop into a dust particle. Is that really possible by 2030? And why would we even want that?
Well, remember, first of all, that within about 10 years, computer power will no longer grow galloping at doubling every 18 months. That's the end of Moore's Law, in which case Silicon Valley could become a rust belt. Would you buy an upgrade? Would you buy a computer knowing that it's just as powerful as last year's Christmas model? No. And so our economy depends upon computers becoming ever increasingly smaller and ever increasingly more powerful. And so we could have a collapse around 10 years from now unless we physicists can create the next generation of computers. Now, there's no law that says we can't make a computer down to the size of a grain of sand, in which case we may be able to create what is called programmable matter, which gives you the possibility of shape-shifting. Shape-shifting is considered magic, science fiction, beyond imagination. But if you can have grains of sand, each one intelligent, and control the charges on each one so they attach to themselves in different ways on command, you could take a car and turn it into a house and turn it into a sink just by pushing a button. Whole cities could rise out of the desert if you push a button. Now, that, of course, is for late in the 21st century. We're not talking about having programmable matter or shape-shifting anytime soon, but it's well within the laws of physics.
All I've ever wanted in a traffic jam was to push a button and have a helicopter propeller appear on the top and fly out of the space, but
we'll have something close in the future. Flying cars are also in the cars. Everyone says, where's my jetpack? Where's my flying car?
I predicted that a long time ago.
Mainly it was science fiction writers who did that. Remember, Arthur C. Clarke that you quoted was a science fiction writer. We physicists know that flying cars are really hard to build because of economics. They exist already. You have two gigantic fans and you levitate them by air. We have that already, but they're really, really expensive. We have to go to magnetism.
And then we'd have people crashing over the streets, wouldn't we?
Well, we would have to have fail-safe systems, that is, super powerful computers that can compensate for gyrations that you make. And magnetism, though, is the way to go. By the end of the century, you may have super magnets and flying cars.
What about the shape-shifting, the nano machines? Could we put them in our bodies?
That's exactly what the National Institutes of Health wants to do, to create smart bombs for cancer. They already exist. This is not science fiction. We can take a molecule, machine it to the right size, so it just fits right into the holes of a cancer cell, which are larger than the holes of an ordinary cell. So we can now fine-tune a molecule to deliver poisons to cancer cells and that are too big to fit in normal cells but just fit right inside cancer cells. We've had 90% success in one test.
My guest is Michio Kaku. His latest book, Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. It's published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How different is this from the DNA chips that you write about?
Well, DNA chips are chips using transistor technology that can pick up, let's say, one cancer cell out of a billion ordinary cancer cells. Mass General Hospital in Massachusetts is already thinking of commercializing it just within the next few years. This could change everything. It means that your bathroom will have more computer power than a modern hospital. Three times a day when you go to the bathroom, it'll analyze for all sorts of diseases and tell you maybe 10 years before you come down with a fatal cancer. So this is going to revolutionize medicine. And we'll think back in the 21st century, chemotherapy will be considered bloodletting and leeches.
It already is by some people, but we have no alternatives right now.
Except smart bombs, that is, nanoparticles that already exist that specifically target cancer cells.
Now, you point out, as others have in the past, that almost every technological advance that we've had so far has come out of military spending or related things. The internet, for example. But military spending is going to be cut considerably. Will that slow the speed of progress?
It might. Realize a GPS system, which we all use today, was once used to guide missiles. The internet was once used to coordinate the rebuilding of America after World War III. And so a lot of the consumer technologies that we take for granted were originally funded by the military. And now we're going to have massive budget cuts, which is very sad because science is the engine of prosperity. You cut science and you cut a pipeline to creating whole new industries of the future, which I think is very sad.
And our schools are having cutbacks as well. There's concern that the scientists of the future won't be as well prepared here as they are in other countries.
That's right. And remember that China is not foolish. They're sending their best minds to the United States and to Europe to fill up graduate programs. I have nothing against that because they help to fill up our program. It turns out that in the United States, 50% of all PhD candidates in physics are foreign-born. And the H-1B visa, the genius visa, makes it possible for Silicon Valley to replenish itself with high-tech geniuses that come from all over the world. That's preventing the United States from going into free fall because our science educational system is one of the worst known to science.
And then we have immigration policies that make it difficult for people to come here. Your family goes back a couple of generations.
My grandfather was in the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, so he helped to clean up San Francisco after that earthquake.
Now, you mentioned GPS systems. You say that sometime in the future we will not be driving anymore. The GPS system will drive our car for us?
That's right. These are driverless cars. They already exist. For the Discovery Channel, I was actually put in a driverless car. I took my hands off the steering wheel, and I trusted my life to a computer, and the car drove perfectly fine without my hands on the steering wheel.
Well, the car will not wind up texting while it drives or doing all sorts of other things.
Or falling asleep.
Right. So you just program where you want to go, and the car would drive at a safe distance from the car in front of it?
Yeah,
would everybody be driving at 65 miles an hour?
Well, in the future, you'll simply tell the car where to go. It figures out the best route, and it has radar in its fenders in case of an accident. And it actually drives better than humans. On a one-to-one test, it actually is safer than a human driving.
And what will be powering it?
Well, it's powered by the ordinary battery, but it's guided.
So it would be an electric car?
It could be an electric car. I drove one with a gasoline engine, but it uses the GPS system to locate its position to within about a foot. And so it has a memory, it has accuracy, and in the future, you'll even be able to control it mentally, because in the future, we will probably control computers using our mind rather than our mouse.
Will hydrogen power ever be harnessed?
Hydrogen power right now is possible but expensive because it requires an infrastructure. We have to have hydrogen refueling tanks. We have to have fueling tanks that don't explode in case of accidents. But mainly the infrastructure of hydrogen will be rather expensive. And hydrogen cars, as you probably know, are also very expensive. But well, they're well within the laws of physics.
Well, you talked about how, at least for a couple of decades, we will still have problems with greenhouse gases. Hydrogen has been one of the proposals for getting around that. Are there ways for us to slow down the impact of fossil fuels on the environment?
It's difficult. Even with hydrogen, hydrogen does not create new energy. It simply transports existing energy into your car. And where does the hydrogen power come from? It comes from a coal plant. So coal drives the electric car. So even the electric car is not the solution to the problem, because where does electricity come from? Mainly from coal. That's why to replace coal, we're actually talking about much more advanced technologies, including fusion, as well as wind and solar.
But you talk about technical fixes that we can do.
Well, these are so-called doomsday fixes, like if the greenhouse effect really gets out of control, we may have to mobilize rockets to shoot basically pollutants into the air to block sunlight. We know from Mount Pinatubo blowing up in Mount St. Helens that volcanic ash cools down the earth. So this would be a major, major doomsday scenario that we would shoot rockets to deflect sunlight.
We just saw Watson do very well on Jeopardy. But you talk about emotional robots in the future. Is that a good idea?
I think it's a good idea. First of all, Watson is like a one-trick pony. You cannot talk to Watson. You cannot joke with it. You can only play Jeopardy with Watson. So most computers today, most robots are one-trick ponies. So don't feel that they're going to take over anytime soon. We're not going to have robots that approach human intelligence for quite a while.
What about space travel? We're pretty much eliminating it for the near future. Will there be a new generation of rockets, a new way of dealing with it?
Well, yeah, the fundamental problem that Obama faces is cost. It costs $10,000 to put a pound of anything in orbit. Imagine your body made out of solid gold. That's what it costs to put you just in orbit around the Earth. To put you on the moon is about $100,000 a pound. To put you on Mars is about $1 million a pound. So imagine your body made out of diamonds, and you begin to understand how much it costs to put you on Mars.
So antimatter rockets, is that the way?
Now, late in the 21st century, all new options begin to open up to go to the stars. We will have gone past Pluto by the end of this century, and we will start to send the first probes to the stars. And I think antimatter engines, fusion engines, ramjet fusion engines, are a distinct possibility to take us to the nearest star.
What about the negative aspects of all of this? There are many people concerned about people being addicted to the new technologies. They can't turn off their cell phones, even in theaters. And then the cell phones themselves, claims are that they cause cancer, brain cancer. Can we be sure that these new technologies will be any safer?
Well, all technologies come with a risk, but privacy is something that will be much more important in the future. Remember that people feared the internet because it would become Big Brother. The problem is not Big Brother. The problem is Little Brother. Nosy busybodies, Nigerian scams, all the stuff that you see on the internet that really impedes progress, that's Little Brother. But there are downsides. For example, we will extend the lifespan of humans. We'll probably go to age 30 and maybe decide to stay at age 30 for several decades. But what happens to the population? Well, fortunately, the population will probably drop as a consequence, because when people live longer and become richer, they have fewer children.
We'll just have perpetual baby boomers.
Yeah, people that never grow old, basically. We're making enormous strides unraveling the aging process at the molecular and genetic level. And it's conceivable that in the future, our grandkids may decide to stop aging at around 30.
Well, this will all be after I'm dead.
Who knows?
Speak for you,
maybe
Mitchell.
We can
you
make
have
a
friends
in our
abyss.
Generation.
But you said that Big Brother isn't watching. We have done shows recently in which we talk about just how much Big, whatever we want to call it, can know about us. The Wall Street Journal has been running a series on how advertisers can even figure out if we watch a certain show, what we're going to buy. They can focus ads specifically to us, and it's getting scary.
Well, if you read 1984 about really what Big Brother can look like, it is really scary. I read that in high school and practically had nightmares when whole governments manage every single second of your time. That's Big Brother. What we have now is a nuisance. We have advertisers trying to figure out your preferences, scammers, criminals. That's Little Brother. And I think we're going to have to create software to protect ourselves. Right now, the software people want to write things for iPads and iPods. But eventually, we'll have software to protect us.
Michio Kaku is professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, one of the founders of string field theory, and the best-selling author of Hyperspace and Physics of the Impossible, the basis for his Science Channel TV show, Sci-Fi Science, The Physics of the Impossible. He also hosts two radio shows, Explorations and Science Fantastic. And his latest book is called Physics of the Future: How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. It's published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure.